Buddhist Summer School, Saturday afternoon, 25th of August, 1984. Venerable sirs and venerable lady and friends, it is really heartwarming to see all of you again this year. And I hope that if it is so decreed by the fates, we shall meet again and again in the future. But it has to be decreed by the fates, I'm afraid. It's not in my power. How fortunate we are to meet once more under these auspicious circumstances. We are met to learn how to loosen the bond of mortality, to remove the veils of ignorance and the cobwebs of illusions and delusions, to fulfill the way of wisdom, and to make a complete end of all ill. That is what the Buddha is to say to the bhikkhu when he invited him, "Ehi bhikkhu, come here. Live the holy life in order to make a complete end of all ill." That sentence needs a lifetime of meditation to understand in full, and a lifetime of the practice of the living of the holy life. What better cause can there be for rejoicing? Peacefully, silently, singly, we are met to try to lose everything a greed-enslaved world grasps at, to lose the deadly sorrow produced by malevolence and ill will, fear and suspicion, violence and hate, to lose our senseless pursuit of vain chimeras masquerading as noble ideals or promoting worthy causes or salving our fellow human beings. We are met to lose our ignorance of truth. We are met to realize freedom, peace, and purity, something the world needs very, very badly today. We are met to release the beauty and joy of the Buddha Dhamma. There is nothing so beautiful as the Dhamma, the Buddhist Dhamma, and all the dharmas that exist in the world, because it is they, these dhammas, which relate us back to the source from which we arise and fulfill the purpose of our existence. And nothing can be more beautiful than that. When one becomes conscious, clearly conscious of the nature of reality, of truth itself, then beauty is absolutely enshrined there. That was one of Plato's supreme contributions during his lifetime. Truth, goodness, beauty. The great ideas of Plato. The Buddha Dhamma is our own Dhamma. Our own because the Buddha nature is the dynamic creative energy in the very heart of our being, animating every single life pulse. If we doubt this, if we deny it, then be assured we are a sorrowful burden upon the world, an imposthume, an abscess, a barb. Imposthume means abscess. Then it would be best if we departed and ceased to befoul the sweet air of the sanctuary of holiness. That sanctuary, essentially, is our own bodily being. I shall speak a little bit more about the body and its significance in one of the future talks. The bodily being is the Brahmapura, the divine city. Let us look for a moment or two at a curious piece of evidence of a powerful source of the world's sorrow. It occurs on page 58, volume 2, of the 1916 reprint of Roger's Thesaurus of English Words and Phrases, under list number 984, which deals with heterodoxy. Here, out of 69 synonyms, we have the following: backsliding, heresy, antichrist, superstition, fanaticism, credulity, paganism. Now listen carefully. Judaism, Mohammedanism, Buddhism, etc. Under number 986, headed Pseudo-Revelation, we have Veda, Zandavasta, Purana, Pitaka. And under False Prophets and Religious Founders, Buddha, Zarathustra, Confucius, Muhammad, Krishna, etc. I've omitted a good few. The ill mind, the sick psyche, which produces all this is the world's source of sorrow. Peter Marc Roger, who lived 90 years, 1779 to 1869, was an English physiologist and author. Between 1798 and 1846, he wrote several books on electricity and magnetism, on animal and vegetable physiology, on phrenology, and on the economic chessboard, all of which have gone the way of so much intellectual lumber. But his Thesaurus of Words and Phrases, which came out in 1852 and underwent 12 editions by 1904 by different learned scholars, still holds an important place. Let us hope that a future editor, graced with wisdom rather than burdened with learning, will correct the erroneous impressions given by numbers 984 and 986 in connection with the headings of heterodoxy and pseudo-revelation. Maybe Buddhists can contribute to this desirable consummation. In the Ruru Diya Jataka, the Bodhisattva says, "For who would willingly use harsh speech to those who have done a sinful deed, strewing salt, as it were, upon the wound of their fault?" In the light of this compassionate teaching, let us refrain, therefore, from any stinging criticism of Roger and his editors. And also, following the instruction in Buddha Ghosha's Visuddhimagga, Nyanamoli's translation, pages 321 and 340, we need not waste any energy suffusing these dead men with metta or karuna or mudita. We need only maintain upekha. In our 1982 gathering, we considered in some detail, in my first talk, the four signs which were to be the immediate cause of the great renunciation, namely the decrepit aged man, the sick man, the corpse, and the bhikshu. It was the sight of the bhikshu more than any other sight which urged Siddhartha Gautama to go forth, note, to go forth from home to homelessness, not to go away, for going away is a retreat, a defeat, whereas going forth is a going forward towards a fulfillment. He goes forth determined to find the means to save whoever would have faith in him from the three evils, aging, sickness, death. Precisely this, in bodily terms, is what he did not find. But what he did find was something beyond all price. He discovered the true meaning of deathlessness, and he found the noble eightfold path for its realization. Deathlessness is the fruit of Nibbana. When samsara ends, Nibbana is present and ineffable peace supervenes. Samsara ends when all the turmoil of the psyche has ceased. Then the psyche is still and silent, completely empty, perfectly transparent to the light of transcendence. Prior to that beatific state, the turmoil of the psyche consists of the entire process of unskilled thought, speech, and action, born of the receptive functioning of the senses and the ego-centered reactiveness of the brain and the body to all sense impressions. This turmoil is the consuming fever of the psychophysical organism, ultimately killing it. But if we care to fulfill one of the purposes of our existence, namely to transform our isolative consciousness into a unitarily whole consciousness, we will probably not die before such fulfillment if we can do what is necessary to cure the fever. Unskilled thought, speech, and action has two aspects. One, the obviously unskilled, which is rooted in greed, hate, and delusion. And two, the subtly concealed unskilled, which is self-oriented without our being aware of the self-orientedness. Whatsoever is self-oriented is divisive, disruptive, cutting us adrift from the unitary whole. Many a deed which is regarded by the worldly minded as unselfish or noble or philanthropic usually has a deeply hidden longing for the satisfaction of one's own self-esteem or of winning the good opinion or admiration of others or of gaining spiritual merit. All this is due to the fact that our self-consciousness is isolative and separative. Only in the practical material sphere such self-consciousness is necessary, so that one does not suddenly obstruct a fast-moving bus, or drive off in someone else's car, or mistake someone else's wife for one's own. Unskilled thought, speech and action is unavoidable whilst man lives in bondage to one or other of two extremes. Either as the slave of his pleasure drives, or as the tormentor of his finite temporal being, the nama rupa or psychophysical organism. So the enlightened one taught that he who sought vision, chakku, tranquility, upasamaya, highest knowledge, abhinyaya, that is, clairvoyance, clairaudience, the psychic powers, seeing past habitations, obtaining the certainty of one's own emancipation, etc. Full enlightenment, sambodhaya, peace, nibbanaya. Such a seeker, the Buddha taught, should walk on the middle way. The vast majority of human beings tread the path of self-indulging sensuality. A very small minority, dissatisfied with worldliness, mistakenly tread the self-tormenting ascetic way, blind to the subtle selfness animating them. I, the separate self, must find God or truth or realize Nibbana. The congenitally lazy ones find the sensual path very agreeable until its karmic consequences disillusion them. And death makes an end of the self-inflicted misery of all unwise masochists. Only a very, very small minority have sufficient stamina and intelligence to tread the middle way, which in fact is the supremely happy way. The Buddha declared, "He who is neither a self-tormentor nor a tormentor of others is here now allayed, quenched, become cool, an experiencer of bliss that lives with self, Brahman become." This occurs in the Kandaraka Sutta when he is talking to Pessa, the son of the elephant trainer. And to the bhikkhus present on that same occasion, he says, afterwards, Pessa leaves the leaves and the bhikkhus are left. And he says to them, "Whoso is possessed of the Aryan body of moral habit inwardly experiences the bliss of blamelessness, anavajjasukha. Possessed of the Aryan control over the sense organs, this control is the non-entrancement by the general appearance or the detail of sense impressions. He inwardly experiences the bliss of being unaffected, avyaseka sukha. Because his equanimity and mindfulness are unshaken. Hence, covetousness, dejection, and evil psychical states do not afflict him, for they cannot arise in him through sense impressions or through memory. Therefore, there is freedom from unskilled thought, speech, and action. the turmoil of the psyche is ended. He is now walking easily on the middle way, faring along peacefully and happily. Prior to this, he had to strive hard even to step on to the middle way and to maintain himself steadily on it, for the power of the deceiver and the binder is very great indeed. That deceiver and binder resides within our own brain, nowhere else. It is our own undeniable heritage through an immense evolutionary span, a heritage no one has the power to refuse to accept. It is essential, it really is very essential to understand and be well aware of our present day brain structure and how it has evolved. Our brain bears the evidence of the reptilian, the mammalian, and the modern stages of its evolution from the inside outwards. That is, inside the brain and outwards. Deep inside is the oldest part, the brain stem, which conducts the basic biological functions, digestion, elimination, reproduction, etc., including heartbeat and respiration. Capping the brain stem is the reptilian complex, the seat of aggression, ritual, territoriality, and social hierarchy. This evolved about 400 million years ago in our reptilian ancestors. Surrounding this is the limbic system. Limbic simply means marking a margin or border, that which is the mammalian part of the brain, evolved tens of millions of years ago in ancestors who were mammals who had not yet become primates. This mammalian brain is a major source of our moods and emotions and of our care and concern for the young. On the outside is the cerebral cortex, which evolved millions of years ago in our primate ancestors. Vertebrates appeared on the land about 400 million years ago. Basically, they were air-breathing fish, beginning to modify their fins into primitive legs. About 55 million years later, that is 345 million years ago, appeared the egg-laying reptiles. They were succeeded by the mammals, who did not lay eggs but gave birth to live young. This made a very great difference to the evolutionary process. Intelligent behavior began to evolve with the mammals. Their main subgroup came on the scene about 65 million years ago. These were the primates, with relatively large brains, well-developed eyes, and stereoscopic vision. Gradually, they subdivided into four main subdivisions: the prosimians, like the lemurs, monkeys, apes, and man. Man was committed to a ground-living existence and showed certain unique adaptations of his own. Remember that adaptation is the key to evolution. The development of the cerebral cortex proceeded slowly through vast periods of time occupied by various epochs, the Oligocene, then the early, middle, and late Miocene, then the Pliocene, and then the early, middle, late, and at present, the latest Pleistocene. Early Pleistocene saw Homo erectus about 1.5 million years ago, and he flourished till about 300,000 years ago. Now, the superfamily of the Hominoidea, to be distinguished from the hominids, the Hominoidea, from whom we all developed, we started separating, the apes and finally man, Homo separated, and Homo erectus came into being. He came into being apparently because the forests began to diminish, the grasslands expanded, and our earliest ancestors began to stand upright and run instead of using arms and tail and legs for jumping from tree to tree. Because of that change, finally Homo erectus came upon the scene. But his brain still was nothing like ours. He was followed in the mid-Pleistocene period by archaic Homo sapiens. Don't mix him up with us. About 300,000 years ago, archaic Homo sapiens came on the being. He was man, yes, he was man. Anatomically modern Homo sapiens appears about 45,000 years ago, that is all. We are the direct descendants of Homo sapiens of 45,000 years ago. And he came into being in the latest Pleistocene epoch. Now he is markedly different cranially and subcranially from his archaic predecessor. Cortical activity now only begins to play a dominant role. The importance of the cerebral cortex must not be underestimated. Associated with it are intuition, critical analysis, ideas, inspirations, reading, writing, music, mathematics, and insight into truth. The cortex is the apparatus for the activity of pure mind. Every energy needs a material apparatus for its functioning and its manifestations. The brain is the apparatus, the instrument for all forms of expression of the psyche as well as of pure mind. You may wonder why I mention psyche and mind as if they were different. Well, this is something which I am responsible for myself. I define mind as that archetypal, universal energy which expresses the creative activity of the primordial creative energy. It is universal and archetypal. It's not possessed by anybody. Nobody has a mind. The Buddha himself never used the word psyche. He always said mind. But actually, it is easier if we regard it this way. Because this universal energy, interacting with corporeality, especially the brain, the nervous system, the ductless glands, the bloodstream, and so on, gives rise to our whole psychical life. You see? Now, this is something which the old people just didn't know. So they just used the word mind. But I think the word, if we deliberately define psyche this way and mind this way, we'll get a clearer insight into what actually happens throughout our psycho-mental life. The cortex is indispensable for pure mind. Pure mind cannot use does not use the mammalian and the reptilian part and the brainstem part. It uses the cortex. The reptilian and mammalian brains are associated with the entire psychological process and activities of the imperfect and impure psychophysical organism. That is, we as we are, which the Buddha called the defiled mind. Defiled psyche would be a better term. The reptilian mammalian brain is the instrument of the deceiver and the binder. It may be wiser in our day and age to regard body in a new way. Throughout the past, we have presented the whole man fragmentarily. We have said, on the one hand, he is Atma, Buddhi, Manas, etc. We use all sorts of terms like that, and Sarira. Or we say spirit, soul, mind on the one hand, and body on the other hand. We have singled out spirit or soul or mind as immortal, eternal essence, indestructible, and hence as the pure, perfect, divine, and imperishable. By contrast, the body, which obviously is subject to decay, disease, decrepitude, and death, has been despised, contemned, disparaged, and disvalued. Consequently, man, who is actually made up of everything, who is actually a unitary whole, has split himself up into different parts which are constantly in mutual conflict with each other. We've done it ourselves because we are ignorant of just how we are constituted. We are incapable of being conscious. Emphasize the word conscious. Not merely thinking of ourselves, but being clearly conscious of ourselves as a single nama rupa, a single psychophysical organism. I put it to you that body is not only a psychophysical organism, but it is the totality. The whole of the transcendent, the whole of infinity and eternity is embodied in us. I must accept responsibility for a statement like this because I haven't found it anywhere nor heard anybody speak in these terms. It is impossible for the brain to visualize this. I say that the transcendent totality is completely and wholly embodied in every single atom or virus, in a galaxy or a planet, in a holy one or the very devil himself. Totally embodied. You can't make a picture with the brain. It is the totality. Creative energy, the whole of the imperishable as well as the perishable, manifested as a microcosm. That's what the body is. Such is the self-consciousness of the perfected holy ones. I think they were quite conscious in this way about themselves. It is identical with totality consciousness. This has no relationship to vijnana. Vijnana gets transmuted into this. Ordinarily, if we say nama rupa, we are aware of a nama plus a rupa, two separate ingredients mixed or joined together. We do not have the feel of a single whole reality. Take a practical example. If we have no knowledge of chemistry and we say water, we are ordinarily aware of water as a single element, as a single thing. The study of chemistry tells us that water is a compound of two different elements chemically combined. We also learn that these two elements are gases, not liquids, hydrogen and oxygen, that each has quite different properties from the properties of the other, and that water, the liquid compound formed by their chemical combination, has quite different properties from each of its constituents. Water is indispensable for life. Oxygen supports life, but would kill us if we breathed it exclusively beyond a certain limit. Hydrogen is non-poisonous, but if we breathe hydrogen only, we would die not because of the hydrogen, but for lack of oxygen. In spite of our knowledge that water consists of two different gases chemically combined, most of us are conscious of water as a single unitary substance when we drink it or bathe in it. We are not conscious of this liquid as consisting of innumerable molecules of water, each composed of two atoms of hydrogen chemically combined with one of oxygen. So when, as kids, we first learn chemistry and we want to show off our knowledge to our parents, we say, pass the H2O, please, which is nonsense talk, because H2O represents one molecule of water which is invisible and intangible. Now, we can be conscious of Nama-Rupa as a unitary whole. Oh, I beg your pardon. Now, can we be conscious of Nama-Rupa as a unitary whole and not as a mixture of a material body and an immaterial psyche? The time is not far off when we, or at least some of us, will no longer see the body in separative analytic terms. The body is the totality. Since we have not yet evolved sufficiently far, we are unable to be holistically conscious of anything at all. We remain confined to the isolative and separative consciousness characterizing our subhuman stage of development. That is, we are confined to vijnana. If we can be holistically conscious and live continuously in that manner, we can be fairly free from thought, speech and action being in a state of turmoil, of constant conflict. Consequently, Nama-Rupa can be healthy and serene. Its harmony will find natural expression in thought and speech and action. Science has amassed an immense amount of knowledge of the body, but it is knowledge of the body as an animate material object. Is there no more to the body than that? Since our consciousness is what it is at present, we are conscious of the body as a wonderfully functioning organism. If our consciousness were to become much more sensitive, if it were to outgrow its present limitations imposed on it by space, time, successive change, beginning, growing, and ending, in short, by birth and death, in what manner would we be aware of the body? Would we still be aware of it in terms of the three evils from which the Buddha sought deliverance, namely aging, sickness, and death? Death is associated in our minds with ending, with annihilation practically. There is a feel of annihilation involved here in all cases. If our consciousness reached the culminating point of its evolution, might we not be aware of it all not as birth and death, but as a constant transformation in eternity and not in time. In time there is birth and death. In eternity there is creative action without motion of translation. And this is deathless transformation, or if you like, transmutation. Was this the deathlessness that the Buddha realized whilst bodily alive? What then is the hidden potentiality of the human body? We must remember that man is the microcosm. He is the holographic representation of the whole of totality. Thou art that. Thou art Buddha.